A little over 100 years ago, a little group of men in Europe conspired to deliver the world to a new system. They openly wrote, nothing secret about it, that in their efforts to gain power, they would be justified in doing anything. They would be justified in following the trail of deceit, lies, terror, murder, treason, blackmail. All these things were elevated to virtues.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
The question of communism is in no way related to this inquiry, which is an attempt to get control of the screen and to invade the basic rights of American citizens in all fields. The question here relates not only to the question of my membership in any political organization, but this committee is attempting to establish the right, which is historically denied to any committee of this sort.
We're going to get the answer to that question if we have to stay here for a week. Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It's unfortunate and tragic that I have to teach this committee the basic principles of Americanism.
That's not the question. The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm framing my answer in the only way in which any American citizen can frame his
then
answer
you denied,
to a question
then
which
you,
invades his... Absolutely invades
then you
right.
Deny to you refuse to answer that question. Is that correct?
I have told you that I will offer
right.
My beliefs, my affiliations, and
excuse
everything else to the American public, and they will know where I stand, as they do from what I have written.
Stand away
I
from
have
the stand.
For Americanism for many years, and I
stand
shall
stand away from the stand.
Fight for the Bill of Rights, which you are trying to destroy.
This man away from the stand.
Mr. Bieberman, are you a member of the Screenwriters Guild, or have you ever been a member of the Screenwriters Guild?
Now, Mr. Stribling, I would like to reply to this very quietly. Mr. Chairman, also, if I will not be interrupted, I will attempt to give you a full answer to this question. It has become very clear to me that the real purpose of this investigation...
That is not...
Wait,
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 wait, wait,
...of the motion picture industry.
Mr. Bieberman, are you a member of the Communist Party, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Are you a member of the Communist Party?
Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It is perfectly clear to me, gentlemen, that if you continue in this particular
Mr. Chairman, will you direct the witness
to
answer that question?
You have only one idea, and that is to cause strife in the industry,
you're excused.
Chaos in the industry.
Will you direct the witness to answer that question, Mr. Chairman, before he leaves the stand?
I have not refused to answer the question. I told you before I will answer this question
fully. Now, Mr. Bieberman,
your purpose is to use this to disrupt the motion picture industry, to invade the right not only of me, but of the producers, to their thoughts, to their opinions. And this I will not permit.
As I was trying to prepare for today's show and really getting into the details, the things I wanted to discuss that occurred in the United States between the late 19-teens, really after World War I with the first Red Scare, right through about the mid-1950s with McCarthyism and the second Red Scare, there was this idea that kept reoccurring. And it's something that we've certainly like touched on before, but I want to explain it today in a different way for a different purpose. Now, we all know, and we've beat this topic to death, the hostility that we encounter from other people when we bring up issues or positions that we hold politically, philosophically, educationally, dealing with religion, etc. But from my experience anyway, and maybe you've had a similar experience, I wouldn't be surprised if you had. Some of the times I've been met with the most emotional aggression and hostility, or this is my observation anyway, is when I'm saying something to another person. It could take 10 minutes to explain. It could be something that I can convey to them in a 3 or 4 word sentence, like taxation is theft. This is something that not only could we experience in the political context, but we also can deal with this kind of hostility in our personal lives. And we could be on both ends. We could be the recipients of the hostility, or we actually could have felt hostile towards the other person. But this is basically the interaction that produces the hostility. This is the scene that needs to be set. And I'll use me. I'll be the protagonist here, arguing from the libertarian or voluntarist position. And I'm talking to, you know, the person who has pretty much, you know, because they've got a busy life, they don't have time to look into all this stuff. Basically, they're in the box of what is permissible for mainstream thinking. So, as the hero of the story, I tell them something that I really think that they need to know and they need to understand. And whatever this thing is that I share with them or explain to them, on the surface, at first, that's outrageous. That's never occurred to me before. I've never heard anything like that. I can determine this by the initial facial expression, or they're just that split second reaction. But as it has just a couple of seconds to sink in, they realize that they already knew that. And they've always known that, because it's self-evident. It's obvious. This, from my experience, seems to make people extraordinarily upset. And I don't want to sound like a person in a glass house throwing stones here. I've had this experience in my personal life. You know, maybe you have too. None of us are perfect. I've screwed up a lot in the past, and maybe a significant other points something out to me that deep down I know, but I wasn't ready to hear. Right? Like, I know what I do, but I wasn't ready to confront the reality that somebody else had also observed this. I think if we just want to use very plain language here, this is generally referred to as being defensive. And being defensive isn't about being suddenly shocked by new information. It's more like, oh, shit, they're on to me. This can happen with people who just fear something is so, right? So either know it, or we're getting clues and evidence that make us concerned that something is true, something is real, something is happening, something is changing, right? But we're just not emotionally prepared to actually confront it yet. Well, this is how our minds are working all the time, you know? Reality is reality. It's out there. It's doing its thing. It's not subjective, right? Most of us, barring any kind of physical problem or neurological problem, have this interface system of these five senses that, even though some people can, you know, hear a little better or see a little worse, it provides the brain the same information about one uniform reality. That actually reminds me of a particularly frustrating interaction that I had many years ago when I was trying to explain something to somebody using facts. This used to be a thing that I would try to do. And they said, yeah, Brett, those are just your facts. Nope. You know? They're for all of us. That's how facts work, if they are indeed facts. But a fact, it's an easy word to throw around, and it's a relatively hard thing to actually make a fact. Because of the speed and the frequency, reality is just buzzing around us constantly. Sometimes it's pretty hard to sort things out, to get things straight. We can't process it all. We can't integrate it all. In fact, if you think about the sensory experience of 1 second of your life, and as far as memory is concerned, we integrate almost none of it. Almost none of it. Of all of the billions of pieces of sensory information that could be thrown at us in a minute, we'd be lucky to remember one of them. How does that chair feel right now on your butt? How does your mouth taste? You know, all that stuff is information. We could never keep track of all of it. Now, for too many people, Many of us might even suffer from this in varying degrees. The natural tools we have for attaining knowledge were basically left underdeveloped or severely atrophied by our school experiences. In their place was put something that we today call the mainstream media, right? So this is our new interface with reality, the ultimate appeal to an information authority. And the way it functions is essentially like you sitting there in your chair, you know, with our bony butts and our tasty mouths and every other, the millions if not billions of other sensory inputs that happen in that second, and trying to make sense of it all. And the mainstream media is it's like that 1 second. It's like that 1 second of trying to absorb and process and integrate every sensory experience that you have. It's too much. And most of it doesn't make sense, and most of it is irrelevant to any kind of coherent picture of reality anyway. But in the 21st century, and the more I looked at the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, I started to wonder that even though information was far less voluminous than it is today, actual information or propaganda and rhetoric that masquerades as information, did people have a similar issue? Instead of introspection or examination and sorting and removing contradictions, developing a clear and consistent map of reality as we observe it, which for all of that information, it's impossible to do. Those inputs kind of sink into the subconscious, right? And what's left when somebody asks us, well, what do you think of these commies? What do you think of these moose lambs? What do you think of these Mexicans sneaking across our border? All that readily snaps into the front of our minds is what we were told by somebody else, what we saw on CNN or Fox or MSNBC or heard on talk radio. But there's more to that, and I will come back to that. Now, complicating this further, the danger of the philosophy that we discussed, the philosophy that consumed the American intellectual community in the late 19th and 20th century, the idealism or the idea that that truth is unknowable, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, those are your facts, Brett. It means we never have to do that work of sorting out the contradictions. Because everything is acceptable, right? Don't use your mind to try and develop a coherent picture of reality around you. It's okay. You know what is important, though? What the authorities say. Why don't you just focus on that, and everybody else can just get a head pat. Thanks for your opinion. Your opinion is greatly valued here. But don't try to actually sort it all out. I'm not saying that that's a conspiracy, but that was the danger of that philosophy. And we saw that danger realized throughout the 20th century and right here, right now in the 21st century, in this country. If we can quiet our minds, I don't know if I'm really talking about us, the people who are listening, who I think are pretty self-aware and capable of introspection and capable of honesty with themselves about some of the discomforts of the political and social world around us. But if we can quiet our minds, we realize we are aware of much more than that loud buzzing that is just at the front of our conscious minds. Across a wide spectrum of beliefs and practices, there is a tremendous amount of stock placed in the power of our subconscious minds. From the fruitiest New Agey Birkenstock granola types to somebody like Nathaniel Brandon and his sentence stems, there seems to be a real consensus that greater wisdom, understanding, and enlightenment can be achieved through a better understanding of the subconscious mind and an improved ability to access what lies in the subconscious mind. People out there who go out and vote for Matt Ramney and Barack Obama and talk about how they enjoy paying their taxes and wave flags, they live in the same reality and they interface with it with the same tools that we use. What many of them lack is the vocabulary necessary, the concepts that are necessary, the philosophical grounding that is necessary to truly explain to themselves what deep down they already know. I've been very lucky. And I say this to people, look, I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm not trying to be pedantic. I was very fortunate that I happened to come across the right information and the right people, the right resources, the right websites that I did when I did. If things had gone down just a little differently, I could be the socialist principal of a public high school right now, filling out federal paperwork to get grants, eating blueberry Pop-Tarts and listening to Al Franken on Air America in the background. It was really just a few compelling internet search results that I was lucky enough to possess the curiosity to click on and look into. Maybe like 10 years ago when I was doing research for some graduate school paper that began the process that eventually changed that course. I was lucky. I want to share with you, political people, some of the lessons of my good fortune, I say to them in so many words. What apparently I didn't realize is how explosive those interactions would be if the information that I was trying to share, you know, about politics, about philosophy, about religion, about the treatment of children, stuff that they all already knew and just had kind of decided to not talk about and not think about. Here's another example. Watch Peter Schiff on television. I was just at Porkfest. I saw Peter Schiff briefly, or I think I saw the top of his head in a crowd of people. And I got into a conversation with somebody about Peter Schiff, and I mentioned this YouTube video called Peter Schiff Was Right, where he kind of... you know, it's like a compilation going back to maybe 2003 where he talks about on, you know, Bloomberg or CNBC or, you know, any of these business or market shows about his concerns for the future based on things that he's observing right now. People laugh at him. They ridicule him. You can see the discomfort in their reaction because they live in the exact same reality. And they utilize the exact same tools Peter Schiff utilizes to interface with that reality. Their reaction, you can watch it, you can observe for yourself, is not Peter Schiff is stupid. It's the things Peter Schiff says make me uncomfortable because I already know them and I don't have the courage or integrity to say them to myself or to you. Not that Peter Schiff is any kind of great guy. That's just an example. This seems like we're going to a totally different place, but it's definitely within the ballpark of what we were just talking about. On the far right, there's a lot of discussion. And in conspiracy circles generally, there's a lot of discussion that the president of the United States, a man named Barack Obama, is a secret Kenyan Muslim who was able to launch a political career on the foundation of a forged birth certificate. Have you heard about this? Now, people who are willing to research this or are willing to exist out of what has been approved for mainstream thought are certainly, to me, in most cases, seem like they would be capable of doing their own research or just enough research to understand that it doesn't fucking matter where Barack Obama was born and what does it change if he was born on Naboo. It doesn't matter. So why does this story have so much legs? Why has this story had so much momentum and popularity for years? Because it is an expression of a feeling, and yes, I'm generalizing, that something is wrong with Barack Obama. There is something about Barack Obama that is different, and it makes me uncomfortable. Barack Obama is not like me. What could it be? Well, I hate to go to really the last resort of liberal argumentation here. But in many cases, what it is, a lot of these people are trying to say, I'm scared to have a black president. There is something that is alien to me, foreign to me, about Barack Obama. This story provides for them a way to express that without saying, I'm not frankly crazy about the blacks. I believe that fully. Now, granted, people might believe this story for different reasons. People might have done some homework. There might be some intriguing leads. This story might be true. But what I'm talking about is, why does it have the appeal that it has, considering that a lot of the people who are pushing this idea have never done 5 minutes of their own research on the subject? That's the reason. So what people want is either, based on the examples that we provided so far, shortcuts to explain how they're feeling, or ways around dealing with what they're feeling based on what they, as we all are, have been observing.
I'll give you one more example of what I'm talking about here. This is kind of a distant cousin to the first two, but it relates. Back when I used to work in residential treatment in Vermont, early in my career when I was just a residential staff, and then for a while I was kind of an interim residential supervisor in the dorms, we were often instructed to, and we even had trainings in this, seek out and discover what we called covert behavior. Now, covert behavior, any kind of sneaky, sort of under the radar, against the rules kind of stuff that the kids would engage in. For example, a kid prescribed to a bunch of meds would cheek his meds because of the exciting effects they might produce for other kids, and then sell them to another kid, which is something that is potentially very dangerous. Now, one of the dorms that I worked in, actually most of the time that I worked in the dorms, I worked in this dorm which was for older kids who were smarter, higher functioning, and they had, you know, better social skills. They were really often on the surface very pleasant and polite with the dorm staff, but they also engaged in a lot of sneaky behavior. There was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. These were kids, mostly like 15 to 18. But also, there were these other kids that were actually referred to as barometers. Now, what is a barometer as a human being? This was a way of describing lower functioning kid. Kid who maybe wasn't as good expressing himself, didn't have the same verbal skills, didn't have the same emotional stability. And I can't say this for sure, but it seemed like in a group of kids who were generally higher functioning and on the surface well-behaved, there would be placed a couple of these barometer kids. But why? Well, when something, you know, behind the scenes, under the radar, was going on in the dorm, most of these higher functioning kids were very good about keeping quiet about it. But the barometer kids weren't. Now, they wouldn't go directly to a staff or a supervisor and say, here's what I'm seeing going on in the dorm. here's what people are talking about behind your backs. Because they knew that there would be repercussions for doing that, right? The older kids would know who did it, and sooner or later, this younger, lower functioning, more easily victimized kid would pay a price for being a snitch. So instead of doing any of that, instead of going to the authorities and telling us about what was happening, they would often start freaking out. In other words, they would indicate that there had been a significant change in the pressure in that atmosphere. If anyone was wondering why we used that, you know, terrible term for a human being, a barometer. And we needed to launch an investigation to find out what it was. I wound up taking a kid's electric guitar pretty much apart as a result of one of these investigations and finding weed in it one time. So the point of that whole story is that if people don't have the vocabulary, the concepts, the intellectual or intrapersonal skills to confront a crisis or an uncomfortable situation, the result is often an escalation in sort of unstable, insane behavior, to just use a short, I know that's not the best word, but that's what it looked like. And this behavior was useful to help staff, supervisors, clinicians determine what was going on in the background. So what lessons does that have for us? Well, just to make sure we're being extra clear to eliminate any confusion, I know that was a lot to throw at people in 25 minutes. What weaves those three stories together is this. People have experiences. Now, sometimes those experiences can be fully understood as they happen, or shortly after they can be integrated into some larger map of reality, but not always. People might lack the tools to do that with every experience. So experiences that aren't fully understood can often create feelings. These feelings can often not be fully understood, but they still manifest in action. And people might say, you know, as a result of this, I don't know how to say X, or I am afraid to say X, even though I feel it. And the further manifestation of these feelings is often some kind of irrational action. Now, what I spoke about earlier suggests that I might be a proponent of Jung's collective unconscious. Not so much. Certainly not really a fan of what Freud had to say on the subject either. He kind of attached these mystical properties to the individual unconscious, and I don't believe it's that. I do believe, to a certain extent, in a version of collective consciousness, what has often been called the hive mind or groupthink. And the power of media and the power of authority, that is, the power of authority in the minds of people, is largely responsible, I believe, for the existence of that hive mind. So from there, let's jump to the 1920s in America. If our topic for this show, on the surface anyway, is something called the Red Scare, which really went through two phases, once in the 19-teens and 20s and once in the 1940s and 50s, we can start with a question. What do you think it would have felt like to be a member of the American public in the year 1920? Same question. In 1950. Both of those years right in the middle of post-war periods where a traumatized public is on the lookout with hypervigilance for anything new, for anything different, for anything foreign. And there also is this seemingly irrational paranoia that something is changing, that some kind of invasion is taking place. Today we see this in our president is foreign born.
There's an invasion of illegal aliens, etc., etc. That paranoia existed then as well. All of these are relevant conclusions, right? Taking in all this information and then just directing it to the wrong place, to the wrong target. But was there really something there? Was there really something happening that was worthy of all of that paranoia and hypervigilance? Yes. But it didn't come from Russia. So we left off in the last installment in this series right at the end of World War I. And as the United States enters the 1920s, the political attitudes and conversations are really marked by three emerging trends in political thought. The first is extreme isolationism. The second is extreme xenophobia. And the third is extreme anti-communism. And the isolationism and the xenophobia, not that they were new things, but they were relatively easy to understand as emotional residuals from the horrors of World War I. The anti-communism, the result of the fear, of course, following the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the emergence of this new Soviet threat shortly after. So all of these things interweave and eventually manifest as the first Red Scare. But after the fighting ends in Europe, the Americans actually send troops back to Russia to end a civil war between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. So the United States are supporting the Mensheviks, but the details of the Russian Revolution are not something that we are going to cover right here at this point in the show, but some of them will fit into the story eventually. Back in the United States, the paranoia over communism is continuing to grow. It is fueled in part by a writer named John Reed, who, like George Orwell, who comes along later, considers himself a socialist, but is very critical of the form of socialism, communism, that is taking place in, or really developing in Eastern Europe. Of course, Orwell, who's writing it mostly in the 40s, gets to see it when it's a little bit more fully formed. But Reed's reports, and he's not reporting in any kind of official government capacity, does raise some concerns because the rhetoric of the Soviet Union sounds quite similar to the rhetoric of the IWW, who came under so much scrutiny in the United States around the very same time. And they are talking about a new order, a world revolution, the end of capitalism. So one of the concerned parties is the Attorney General of the United States. His name is A. Mitchell Palmer. Palmer is very public about his antagonism toward socialists and even unions generally. Makes a few enemies. Apparently in 1919, a bomb goes off right in the front of his house. The bomber is killed. Palmer survives, but he's pissed. And within the next 6 months, he starts planning what ultimately becomes known as the Palmer Raids, which really officially go on between November of 1919 and May of 1920. And during this time, about 6,000 people are arrested either for political beliefs or immigration status, or I guess really you could say in many cases a combination of the two. Now, there's an interesting precursor to the Palmer Raids that happens in the summer of 1919, and I think it's important to our story and the main message of this series. There is an anarchist group in Buffalo that Palmer orders raided and arrested, and it's thrown out in court. In other words, even though there is an arrest of this anarchist group, there is no prosecution because they're is obviously protection under the First Amendment. They are talking about, you know, changing the government, not through violence, but through, you know, they're essentially using their quote-unquote First Amendment rights. The lesson for Palmer here is that the political angle, like going after people for their political beliefs, is a vulnerable pursuit
in court at this point. I mean, remember, this is, you know, almost 100 years ago. So the Constitution, that apparently was still kind of a thing then. So instead, he realizes in the post-war climate of the United States, late 19-teens, early 1920s, when there are these strong feelings of xenophobia and isolationism, that he has a better chance of being successful in his anti-communism crusade by exploiting immigration statutes. So using the law to basically authorize the deportation of these people. So it's actually a very clever way of operating behind a legal cover, mostly using labor laws to attack speech and ideologies that were not popular with the status quo beneficiaries or the Wilson administration generally. A personal story from People's History. In January 1920, 4,000 persons were rounded up all over the country, held in seclusion for long periods of time, brought into secret hearings, and ordered deported. In Boston, Department of Justice agents, aided by local police, arrested 600 people by raiding meeting halls or by invading their homes in the early morning. A troubled federal judge described the process, quote, "Pains were taken to give spectacular publicity to the raid and to make it appear that there was a great and imminent public danger. The arrested aliens, in most instances, perfectly quiet and harmless working people, many of them not long ago Russian peasants, were handcuffed in pairs and then, for the purposes of transfer, on trains and through the streets of Boston, chained together." Unquote. In the spring of 1920, a typesetter, an anarchist named Andrea Salcedo, was arrested in New York by FBI agents and held for 8 weeks in FBI offices, not allowed to contact family or friends or lawyers. Then his crushed body was found on the pavement below the building, and the FBI said he had committed suicide by jumping from the 14th floor window. Two friends of Salcedo, anarchists and working men in the Boston area, having just learned of his death, began carrying guns. They were arrested on a streetcar in Brockton, Massachusetts, and charged with a holdup and murder that had taken place 2 weeks before at a shoe factory. They were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. They went on trial, were found guilty, and spent 7 years in jail while appeals went on, and while all over the country and the world, people became involved in their case. The trial record and the surrounding circumstances suggested that Sacco and Vanzetti were sentenced to death because they were anarchists and foreigners. In August 1927, as police broke up marches and picket lines with arrests and beatings, and troops surrounded the prison, they were electrocuted. Sacco's last message to his son Dante, in his painfully learned English, was a message to millions of others in the years to come. Quote, "So, son, instead of crying, be strong, so as to be able to comfort your mother. Take her for a long walk in the quiet country, gathering wildflowers here and there. But remember always, Dante, in the play of happiness, you don't use all for yourself only. Help the persecuted and the victim because they are your better friends. In this struggle of life, you will find more and love, and you will be loved." Unquote. There had been reforms. The patriotic fervor of the war had been invoked. The courts and the jails had been used to reinforce the idea that certain ideas, certain kinds of resistance, could not be tolerated. One of the first men in United States law enforcement to really cash in, so to speak, to really be able to capitalize on communist paranoia, was a man named John Edgar Hoover. He is, in my opinion, from my research, one of the most bizarre and corrupt men to ever hold power in the United States government. Some have argued that Hoover was the most powerful man in the history of the United States government. Actually, well, I would say working in the government itself. Despite all of his corruption and bizarre behavior and really unfair and malicious treatment of some of the people who were working under him in the FBI, Hoover held the highest post at this very powerful organization from 1924 to 1972. Now,
I think it goes without saying that some kind of democratic process is no validation for Hoover's actions. But it's interesting to point out that he was never elected to any office. And when he became the head of the FBI, basically through political connections and his aggressive work during the first Red Scare, the agency was relatively powerless compared to what it is today. It existed as really nothing more than an office inside the Department of Justice. It had no powers of arrest or anything like that. It was through the first Red Scare in the late 19-teens and early 1920s and the second Red Scare in the late 1940s through the early 1950s that helped the organization, along with Hoover's tenacity and complete lack of ethics, to rise to the position of prominence in law enforcement that it has today. It's interesting. Now, Hoover doesn't relate to our story here too much, but he also provides a real warning about the potential dangers of secretive intelligence gathering. I mean, today, it's amazing to hear people say things like, "You have nothing to fear if you have nothing to hide." I think Goebbels actually coined that phrase, but American politicians are using it today. It's shocking to me that anyone would say that after the 50-year reign of J. Edgar Hoover, who is a prime example of the power that a completely corrupt individual can attain through the collection and integration of personal information. For decades, everyone in Washington was terrified of Hoover. Even the people that he was working directly with in the executive branch of government, presidents of the United States, were afraid of J. Edgar Hoover because there was always this question, what does he know? Now, granted, a politician, certainly a president of the United States, might have more skeletons in their closet than the average so-called citizen. But the suggestion that it's just preposterous to concern yourself with this idea that, oh, don't worry about all this information falling into the wrong hands. How could that happen? And just an aside here, it's pretty amusing for me today, June 22nd, to be talking about J. Edgar Hoover and the potential dangers of this kind of government secrecy and government power. A story broke, I think, today. I saw this on multiple news outlets, including Reuters and the Huffington Post, about, we'll call him the original NSA whistleblower. Remember here, we're working our way through a series of shows where we're trying to provide some historical context for this current NSA leak story involving Edward Snowden. But years ago, the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize during the Bush administration for a pretty revelatory story about NSA wiretapping involving a whistleblower named Russ Tice. Well, he's back in the news today. How about this? Now, I'm going to play you an audio clip here in just a second, and I would like you to juxtapose what you're hearing against the damage control that the Obama administration and their apologists in the mainstream media have been doing on this Snowden NSA leak. And if you're unfamiliar, like if you haven't been watching MSNBC or, the White House press secretary's press conferences, which, you know, I don't blame you if you haven't, the damage control essentially is, don't be so paranoid. Don't worry about it. There's oversight. Everything we're doing is following the letter of the law. Well, you know, sometimes shit happens, okay? Because that's what they're saying today in 2013. Now, we're going to hear about something in just a second that happened in 2004. That's almost 10 years ago. Now, you think about what can happen in an organization like the NSA in a period of 10 years. Are they getting better? You know, has there been an ethical, even constitutional revolution in the leadership of this organization that operates completely in the dark over the course of the last decade? Or have things gotten even worse? Because here's what was going on almost 10 years ago.
This was in summer of 2004. One of the papers that I held in my hand was to wiretap a bunch of numbers associated with a 40-some-year-old wannabe senator from Illinois. You wouldn't happen to know where that guy lives right now, would you? It's a big White House in Washington, D.C. That's who they went after. They went after, and that's the president of the United States now. This thing is incredible what NSA's done. They've basically turned themselves, in my opinion, into a rogue agency that has J. Edgar Hoover capabilities at a monstrous scale on steroids.
The title of this piece from Huffington Post, Russ Tice, Bush-era whistleblower, claims NSA ordered wiretap of Barack Obama in 2004. It reads, Russ Tice, a former intelligence analyst who in 2005 blew the whistle on what he alleged was massive unconstitutional domestic spying across multiple agencies, claimed Wednesday that the NSA had ordered wiretaps on phones connected to then-Senate candidate Barack Obama in 2004. Speaking on The Boiling Frog Show, Tice claimed that the intelligence community had ordered surveillance on a wide range of groups and individuals, including high-ranking military officials, lawmakers, and diplomats. So I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to make it sound like no one in government learned a lesson from the existence of J. Edgar Hoover. They learned a very valuable lesson as far as they were concerned, but not a very constructive one. And that lesson was, hey, we could probably do all of that Hoover stuff too. So that was kind of a fun tangent, wasn't it? But let's try to get back to the 1920s. So Hoover's made by the Palmer Raids, but the Palmer Raids are just one of many reactions to the fears. First time in U.S. history, the U.S. government actually places caps on European immigration, forcing the society to be even more isolationist, or responding, I guess, to an isolationist sentiment from the public. And all communist, all Russian literature is banned from the United States. So we have immigration restrictions and literature bans, but there's another thing that also happens during this time. This one's kind of interesting, prohibition. There's really two groups of people behind this. The first are generally referred to as progressive reformers, and the second group are xenophobes. So progressive reformers were part of what was often referred to as the temperance movement and had existed like since Puritan times. You know, very religious, and they saw alcohol as sinful. It made people do sinful things. And they unfortunately had been failing for centuries to have it removed from American life entirely. More important here are the xenophobes. They see alcohol as a vice and a sin brought to America, Puritan America, by immigrants, especially Catholic immigrants. And they begin to equate or force people to equate drinking with un-Americanism and the evils of city life where lots of immigrants live. So this old and stupid idea of placing legal restrictions, you know, banning the consumption of alcohol in the United States, actually gets some new momentum during all of the nationalistic fervor of World War I. Because this was a time, I mean, we mentioned this before, this is a time where we were renaming things, right? Like, you can't have German toast, you can't be eating delicious German toast, or fighting the Germans, that'll be French from now on. And we also have, ooh, Liberty Cabbage, which is sauerkraut. So remember, too, though, a lot of imported beer from Germany. And the solution amidst this nationalistic fervor is ban that beer. Ban that German beer. And right after the war, 1919, Congress passed the 18th Amendment, and it was the law of the land. From 1919 to 1933. And if we chalk it up as, you know, one of the consequences of nationalist and xenophobic anti-communist paranoia, well, you could say that some other folks were able to cash in on communism. It was called organized crime. It was called the mafia. Something that had existed in the United States since the 1800s in some degree, but it was really this period, Prohibition, the 1920s, that put organized crime, especially La Cosa Nostra, on the map in the United States. But there were more signs and effects, really, of some of the attitudes that were really prevalent in the 1920s. Just to refresh your memory, extreme xenophobia, extreme anti-communism, and isolationism. And, you know, we can put nationalism into that as well. But this old group from the South returns to prominence in American political life, called the Ku Klux Klan at this time. Now, they had just been in the South, but, you know, with all of this excitement about hating foreigners, they spread all over the country. They actually get really, really strong in the Midwest.
they expand the lists of people they hate, you know? It's not just blacks. We had immigrants, Catholics, the Jews. And the Klan is as big as it will ever get. You know, you think about this as a creature of the Reconstruction South, you know, after the Civil War. The Klan reaches its height in 1925. 4.5 million members in the United States. Now, there are politicians. Powerful men, you know. Mayor of Denver. There was a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Open member of the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, politicians who were seeking public office on a national level, a lot of them in certain places, they had to play to the Klan to get votes. They're so mainstream that their messages make it into this exciting new medium called motion picture film. So there's a book called The Klansman. It is made into a movie by the pioneer filmmaker D.W. Griffith, Birth of a Nation. And it is such a technical feat. I mean, this movie, really, if you're a student of film, Birth of a Nation is like a film you should see. Not for its message, but, you know, for its technical achievement. And this, it was a huge hit. They took it to the White House. Wilson loved it. There's a lot of, and Wilson, this is a story for another time. God, Wilson sucks. This is a story for another time, though. There's a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me. And, you know, it talks about heroification, something we've talked about on the show before. And it's really, really, rightfully so, harsh on Woodrow Wilson and the racism that permeated through his administration. And there's a lot of speculation that Wilson was not just sympathetic to the Klan, but kind of in it. So needless to say, the Klan has an escalating effect. The popularity of the Klan has an escalating effect on the xenophobia, anti-immigrant, anti-African-American feelings in the United States. So there's a huge increase in race riots.
And there's also, at this time, a huge increase in the occurrences of lynching.
And basically the way that works is, you know, it wasn't really random. I think in a lot of places a person would be accused of a crime. Of course, the accusation could just be completely fabricated for the sake of having a lynching. And people would actually be dragged out of jail, you know, where they were being held, and they would be hanged, often burned. And, you know, this was the 1920s in the United States of America. Race riots, lynching, xenophobia,
seemingly sudden resurgence of Puritan values, at least with respect to alcohol.
What do you think it would have felt like to be an adult member of the American public in 1920? Remember, public schools well established at this point, at least for grades 1 through 8. And that myth of American exceptionalism, America the freest, the best, all that mythology existed then and was surely being pounded into the heads of these kids in these schools. At the very least, that indoctrination existed to the extent that the government and the Committee on Public Information could build the idea that America was going to fight a war that involved a form of slavery called conscription to make the world safe for democracy. But what would that have been like to observe that decade, the 19-teens? And for reasons most people cannot understand, the establishment of the central bank, the income tax, all these increases in government powers, the Sedition Act, the Espionage Act, America enters the violent world of imperialism, and, you know, we could argue America was always, America's a state, right? It's a country. It's a government. It was imperialist right from the beginning because that's what the governments do if they can. But this was different, right? The threat of foreign invaders. It was a decade of very dramatic change and discomfort. So all of that speaks to the fact that in the foreground, in history, we are essentially watching the public just go completely batshit insane. And in the background, something else is happening. The United States government itself, at this time, is being transformed. Not just internally, but externally as well, as far as what its purpose, what its role in the world will be in the coming decades. It's a process that began in the 19-teens, if not sooner. Certainly relates to the new imperial pursuits, the imperial pursuits that not only terrorized Central and South America during the administrations of people like Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, but also the new interest in being an imperial power that led the United States into World War I. Well, around the world, the nations that held the greatest power prior to the war are not in the best shape, physically, socially, economically. And the United States, not to over-personify here, because it is very much about to become a tool for other people who are rarely discussed in any history book that I've ever seen. But there's a new opportunity, right? And just as socialism, and I would even say, oh, I'm going to get letters, but progressivism in general can really be summed up as the greatest evil disguised as the greatest good. The United States itself is about to be used in a similar capacity by a group of men with a plan, an open conspiracy, if you will, to bring the entire world under their control. And by this point in the 1920s, they already have a nice head start on that project.
Formed in 1921, some believe this is the most powerful private institution in the United States, if not the world. To become a lifetime member, you must be a U.S. citizen or resident, nominated in writing by another full member, and sponsored by three more. Despite these high standards, many people manage to join lifetime members. I was surprised by how many of these individuals are celebrities, public faces in the news, movies, and business world. But you'll have to do a bit of research to find the members list, and odds are you'll never know what they talk about. A notorious secrecy clause prevents these world leaders from discussing their meetings. This secrecy is disturbing because the membership roster is so comprehensive. It reads like a who's who of the American elite.
Guy sounds pretty paranoid, doesn't he?
Heads of state, captains of industry, the mainstream media, the average American has no idea what this group does or how it works. We can only guess, and in guessing, we must look to the history of this secret cabal, its predecessors, its founders, and the skeletons in its closet. Between 1915 and 1918, a group of 150 scholars called the Inquiry assisted President Woodrow Wilson as he tried to visualize the U.S.'s global role after Germany's defeat in World War I. Their research ultimately led to Wilson's 14 points, a strategy for global peace. When the scholars traveled to Paris in 1919, secret meetings between U.S. and British elites led to the formation in 1921. From that point on, gained more and more power over the U.S. government. Many people, not just conspiracy theorists, believe this organization completely controls U.S. foreign policy, yet it is not a part of the government, and the general public has no control over members. So what do these world leaders plan in secret? In the process, members work behind the scenes with groups the U.S. commonly considers enemies. Researchers present two chilling examples of this possibility. First, the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Many revisionist historians believe the elements of the U.S. government allowed this disaster to occur because it motivated the population to wage war. Second, some sources have traced the business and financial connections of large industries and banks during World War II. They claim that several groups made money off both sides of the war. Follow the money, these researchers say, and you will find that one shadowy group created the situation leading to World War II. In the aftermath of this conflict, the same group consolidated their control over foreign governments. But who is this group?
Oh, but suddenly, we jump to the late 1940s in our story. In a period of time known as the Second Red Scare, this will all make sense. Now, we should talk a little bit about what this is. There are some similarities to the first Red Scare in that a world war ends and suddenly this ominous enemy in Russia seems to be gaining power. And people in America use that as a target for some kind of generalized, trauma-driven paranoia. In fact, this gets started as early as 1947. Harry Truman issues an executive order and creates something called the Federal Employees Loyalty Program. Now, is there some surface justifications for this paranoia? I mean, again, the tactics, never a fan of them. Never a fan of the tactics that government uses to try and root out the communist or collectivist threat, but there is a real motivator. And most of it stems from the trial and the conviction and execution of a couple named Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And their charge was that during World War II, they were passing information about the American atomic bomb project to the Soviet Union. So certainly we've covered this before, but the atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were not, as we might learn in our public schools, about a last resort to end a brutal war that would have killed far more people than the about 200,000 that died in those blasts in Japan. And yeah, it needed to be done. The more horrifying something that government does, the more propaganda needs to kind of go into justifying it. So there's lots of stories about why the atomic bomb was necessary and how brutal the Japanese were. And the Japanese were brutal. I mean, that's not a lie. But killing, a couple hundred thousand innocent people, yes, that requires a justification plan. So the story is that the Japanese refused to surrender. And this was basically this act of terrorism, that word is never used, would convince them to surrender because the bombs would just keep coming if the war continued. The Japanese had made, not that they're the protagonists in this story, but they had made an effort to surrender. The condition that they placed on the surrender was that their emperor would stay in power. The U.S. And the PR campaign related to the end of the war was unconditional surrender, so that condition could not be honored. The bombs were dropped. Japan surrendered and kept their emperor anyway. What the bombing of those cities was really about, it was a message job, to use some organized crime language, directed towards the Soviet Union. It was well understood that the Soviets would emerge in a unique position of power in Europe. The Western European powers are essentially destroyed again by the war. The Soviets and the Americans find themselves emerging from the ashes as the two superpowers, and the message of the atomic bomb is like, here's something that we have just in case, you're thinking about your expansion of communism. So the Rosenberg trial, conviction, and execution is used as kind of the jumping off point or the reasons behind this second wave of paranoia related to some kind of foreign invasion, and more accurately, subversion and infiltration of the American way of life. And the increased controls of government began by Harry Truman in this phase of the Red Scare, anyway, the 40s and the 50s, seemed to pay off largely through the work of a committee called HUAC. That's an acronym for House Un-American Activities Committee, and its investigation into a man named Alger Hiss, another government employee. This body, actually, in one form or another, had existed since the 19-teens. It was not a standing committee in the House of Representatives until the end of the war in 1945. But there were several examples of prior investigations that had taken place on, quote-unquote, un-American activities. One of the most famous, from 1934 to 1937, was called the McCormick-Dickstein Committee. Oh, hold that thought. Oh, what a tangled web we weave, folks. McCormick-Dickstein Committee. That will come back. But right now, we're in the late 1940s, and we're talking about the Standing Committee of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And in other words, Standing Committee is that it's permanently there. It's not something that's convened for a purpose. It always exists. In fact, this form of the committee exists until it is abolished sometime in the mid-1970s. And basically, under the mandate of some law that Congress passes, there are 9 permanent members who are tasked with investigating specific threats of subversion that, and this is their language, attack the form of government guaranteed by our Constitution. So this is potentially somewhat broader than just government employees looking for or trying to establish a loyalty test for people who are actually inside the federal government. This committee has the power now
to deal with anybody, you know, especially using the momentum of their quote-unquote success with Alger Hiss in 1948, anyone who has a position of influence over the American public. These were interesting times.
Attention, attention. This is an official civil defense warning. This is not a test. The United States is under nuclear attack. Take cover immediately in your carrier fallout shelter. Repeat, the United States is under nuclear attack.
America's Cold War years were filled with fear. Daily radio and newspaper reports blared frightening stories of advancing communism, imminent nuclear war, and Soviet spies. America responded with an all-out offensive against communist infiltration.
The growing menace of communism arouses the House of Representatives Un-American Activities Committee. Among the well-informed witnesses testifying is J. Edgar Hoover, head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. Hoover speaks with authority on the subject.
Communism in reality is not a political party. It is a way of life, an evil and malignant way of life. It reveals a condition akin to disease that spreads like an epidemic. And like an epidemic, a quarantine is necessary to keep it from infecting this nation.
While Hoover's FBI worked behind the scenes, Congress expanded its own high-profile investigations, often ignoring the civil rights of the accused.
Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I believe I have the right to be confronted with any evidence which supports this question. I should like to see what you have.
Oh, well, you would.
Yes.
Beginning in 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, investigated communist influence in Hollywood. The committee was concerned with the power of movies to persuade audiences with subversive messages. With movie stars and other industry professionals called to testify, the hearings became red carpet events. For the anti-communist witch hunt, it was a publicity bonanza.
It is completely against the un-American feeling, this communistic thing. I believe I would move to the state of Texas if it ever came here, because I think the Texans would kill them on sight.
We have sold them some films a good many years ago. They bought the Three Little Pigs and used it through Russia.
If I had my way about it, they'd all be sent back to Russia or some other unpleasant place.
Most witnesses cooperated with the committee. However, a small group who became known as the Hollywood Ten refused to answer questions, citing protection under the First Amendment. Among them, screenwriter John Howard Lawson.
The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I am framing my answer in the only way in which any American citizen can frame his
then
answer
you denied,
to a question
then
which
you,
invades his... Absolutely invades
then
his
you
life.
Deny to... You refuse to answer that question. Is that correct?
I have told you that I will
offer right.
My beliefs, my affiliations, and
here's
everything
the
else to the American public, and they will know where I stand, as they do from what I have written.
Stand away
I
from the stand.
I have for Americanism for many years, and I...
Stand away from the stand.
For the Bill of Rights...
Stand away from the stand. Therefore, it is the unanimous opinion of this subcommittee. John Howard Lawson is in contempt of Congress.
The Hollywood Ten were convicted of contempt and sent to prison. Thousands of others were blacklisted by the studios, forcing many talented movie makers into exile and obscurity. Among the friendly witnesses who testified in 1947 was a B-movie actor named Ronald Reagan. No one could have suspected that four decades later, Reagan would play a leading role in bringing the Cold War to an end.
If communists have attempted to inject their propaganda into the motion picture, they have failed miserably.
Perhaps Hollywood wasn't influenced by communists, but it was affected by the hearings. Movie studios added to the hysteria by cranking out such anti-communist films as Is This Tomorrow?, Red Planet Mars, and dozens of others. But tawdry films did little to distract President Truman from what he saw as a perversion of American democracy.
Now I'm going to tell you how we're not going to fight communism. We're not going to transform our fine FBI into a Gestapo secret police. We're not going to try to control what our people read and say and think. We're not going to turn the United States into a right-wing totalitarian country in order to deal with a left-wing totalitarian threat. In short, we're not going to end democracy. We're going to keep the Bill of Rights on the books.
Against the president's objections, Congress passed more dubious legislation, including the Internal Security Bill of 1950, which empowered the government to take action against anyone it deemed a security risk. Truman called it the greatest danger to freedom of speech, press, and assembly since the Alien and Sedition Laws of 1798.
Now, it's also worth pointing out that the voice of that pretty belligerent questioner on the committee in the whole Hollywood thing, that is not Joseph McCarthy. These two things are often confused, but McCarthy is not involved in this phase, the HUAC phase and the Hollywood investigations at all. McCarthy never even works for HUAC. And the reason why I think that's important to point out is because as the 50s go on, there is an escalation, not only in the paranoia, but in the government's response to it, so to speak. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them, they mentioned that obviously Hollywood is very influential, very public, which is one of the reasons why the committee started with Hollywood or made such a public to-do of their investigation into Hollywood, because it would have this mass appeal. And in many cases, we've all seen these clips, or maybe there's a movie, there's this Robert De Niro movie from the early 90s called Guilty by Suspicion that focuses on the people who stood up, which, you know, became known as the Hollywood 10. But most of the people were friendly witnesses, you know, Gary Cooper, send him back to Russia, you know, that kind of stuff, Ronald Reagan. So it was really this publicity scheme for HUAC as well. Hollywood's response, for the most part, was not to use art to fight this encroachment on civil liberties of American people. It was to go along with what the government wanted and to produce these anti-communist propaganda films that also drummed up public fear. The function of the committee also contributed to the escalation of paranoia and hypervigilance, in that the only way you could remove yourself from the conspiracy, once we really got into this, was to expand the conspiracy. And by that I mean, what they wanted people to do was to name names. So if they had something on you, like you were affiliated with some kind of reading group that had been deemed anti-American, you could basically implicate yourself as being guilty by an unwillingness to discuss who else was in that group. Or you could expand the scope of the conspiracy by giving 10 names of other people who attended that reading group or that whatever that political interest group might have been. So HUAC is a House committee, but this investigation also moves to the Senate, which is where McCarthy finally comes into it in the 1950s. And that takes us back to the focus on infiltration by people, not of society or public consciousness or anything like that, but in the government itself. And that's the name I mentioned before, Alger Hiss. And the development of this story followed a similar pattern to the whole Hollywood thing. It was 1948, and a woman named Elizabeth Bentley had worked as a Soviet agent in the United States. And she, to exonerate herself or lessen her charges, named a couple other names. One was a man named Whitaker Chambers. So Chambers was subpoenaed. He appears shortly after that. He had been a Soviet spy, and he gave five or six names of people who had also been working on similar projects, and one of those names was Alger Hiss. What's different here about what was going on in Hollywood, not that there might not have been Soviet-influenced infiltration of Hollywood as well, the consensus seems to be that Hiss was, in fact, spying for the Russians. He denied all of his charges. He was eventually convicted and imprisoned, but it was perjury that got him. In the mid-90s, for whatever this is worth, which might not be much, there was a declassification of something called the Venona Project. So the Venona Project, it was basically a decryption agency that was intercepting telegrams sent to the KGB during World War II. One of the people, or one of the code names, is Ailes, A-L-E-S, and there was considerable evidence presented that I'm not going to get into here. This is a very easy thing to track down information on if you're interested. The conclusion essentially was that Ailes was Alger Hiss. So when these investigations or these draconian measures seem to, as far as members of the public and government officials are concerned, seem to have a payoff in this fight against communism, well, that's justification for the existence of those programs, and they continue, and they escalate, and that brings us to this Joseph McCarthy.
One communist on the faculty of one university is one communist too many. One communist among the American advisors at Yalta was one communist too many. And even if there were only one communist in the State Department, even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
The question, why is it important to you, the people of America, to know why the educational director and the vice president of CBS so closely follows the Communist Party line? To answer that question, we must turn back the pages of history. A little over 100 years ago, a little group of men in Europe conspired to deliver the world to a new system, to communism. Under their system, the individual was nothing, the family was nothing, God did not even exist. Their theory was that an all-powerful state should have the power of life or death over its citizens without even a trial, that everything and everybody belonged to the rulers of the state. They openly wrote, nothing secret about it, that in their efforts to gain power, they would be justified in doing anything. They would be justified in following the trail of deceit, lies, terror, murder, treason, blackmail. All these things were elevated to virtues in the communist rule book. If a convert to communism could be persuaded that he was a citizen of the world, it of course would be much easier to make him a traitor to his own country. Now for 70 years, the communists made little progress. Let me show you a map of the world as it stood in the middle of the First World War in 1917 before the Russian Revolution. You will see there was not a single foot of ground on the face of the globe under the domination or control of the communists. And bear in mind that this was only 36 years ago. In 1917, we were engaged in a great world war in defense of our way of life and in defense of American liberty. The Kaiser was obliged to divide his armies and fight on both the Eastern and the Western fronts. In the midst of the war, the Russian people overthrew their czarist master, and they set up a democratic form of government under the leadership of Alexander Kerensky. Now, Kerensky's government instantly pledged all-out support to the Allies. At this instant, the Imperial German government secretly financed the return to Russia of seven communist exiles led by Nikolai Lenin, exiles who had been forced to flee the country. A rather important event in the history of the world. Now, once in Russia, by the same methods which the communists are employing in the United States today, they undermine the army, they undermine the navy, the civilian heads of the government. And in 100 days, those seven communists were literally the masters of Russia. Now, with all of the wealth of the nation at their command, they proceeded to finance communist parties in every country of the world. They sent to those countries trained propagandists and spies. In every country, they, of course, had to find glib, clever men like Edward R. Murrow, who would sponsor invitations to students and teachers to attend indoctrination schools in Moscow, exactly as Murrow has done. They trained communists in every country in the world. Their sole purpose was to infiltrate the government, and once communists were in government, they in turn brought others in. Now let us look at the map of the world as it was 20 years ago. At that time, there was one country with 180 million people in communist chains. Now let us look at a map of the world as of tonight, this 6th day of April 1954. Over one-third of the Earth's area under communist control, and 800 million people in communist chains. In addition to the 800 million in communist chains in Europe and Asia, finally, the communists have gained a foothold and a potential military base here in our half of the world, in Guatemala, with the communists seeping down into the Honduras. My good friends, how much of this was achieved by military force, and how much was achieved by traitors and communist lying propagandists in our own government and in other free governments? Let's start in Europe, if we may. They took by military force a little piece of Finland. In the same way, they took three small Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. They took half of Poland in the same way. They acquired the rest of Poland through Polish traitors and communists in our own government who gave American dollars and American support to the communists in Poland. They took over Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary without firing a single shot. They did this by the infiltration of communists in a key spots in the governments. The communists took over Czechoslovakia without firing a shot. This they did by the infiltration of communists into the Czechoslovakian government also. And listen to what a high official in the anti-communist government of Czechoslovakia had to say about the communist enslavement of Czechoslovakia. Here's what he said. He said, in my country, the pattern was identical to what it is in the United States. If anyone, before the communists took over, dared to attack those communists who were preparing and shaping the policy of my government, shaping the policy to betray my people, he was promptly attacked and destroyed by a combination of communists, fellow travelers, and those unthinking people who thought they were serving the cause of liberalism and progress, but who were actually serving the cause of the most reactionary credo of all times, communism. Still quoting, because of those people, night has fallen upon my nation and slavery upon my people. If there were no communists in our government, why did we delay for 18 months, delay our research on the hydrogen bomb, even though our intelligence agencies were reporting day after day that the Russians were feverishly pushing their development of the H-bomb? And may I say to America tonight that our nation may well die, our nation may well die because of that 18 months deliberate delay. And I ask you, who caused it? Was it loyal Americans or was it traitors in our government? It is often said by the left wing that it is sufficient to fight communism in Europe and Asia, but that communism is not a domestic American issue. But the record, my good friends, is that the damage has been done by cleverly calculated subversion at home and not from abroad. It is this problem of subversion that our committee faces.
McCarthy gave that speech in the mid-1950s, when he had already been forced by a certain journalist to take a defensive posture. But at the time of that speech, it's worth pointing out that the American political system had already absorbed, in varying degrees, all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. Was it the result of a true communist conspiracy of infiltration and subversion directed from Russia? Well, if you look at the chronology of these changes to the American political system as defined by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, it's a difficult argument to make, because some of these ideas that seem to originate in the Communist Manifesto came into the American system prior to Marx and Engels writing that book in 1848, and a few more prior to the Russian Revolution of 1917. Let's look a little closer. The first plank, the abolition of property and land in the application of all rents of land to public purposes. Not fully swallowed, but it can be argued that zoning laws, which were ruled by the Supreme Court to be constitutional in 1921, were a step in that direction. Contributing further to this, property taxes, motor vehicle registrations, all kinds of other business regulation and personal and business licensing. It could be argued that you really don't even have complete ownership over the dollars in your savings account, because the government can continue to print money and devalue the currency you already hold. That one ties into another plank as well. The second plank, a heavy, progressive, or graduated income tax. Well, the Corporate Tax Act was introduced in 1909. The 16th Amendment was ratified in 1913. We also have the Revenue Act of 1913, Section 2, which deals with income tax. There is a tremendous amount of debate as to whether or not these laws apply to American citizens, but the court seemed to have decided that, in fact, they do. The third plank, abolition of all rights of inheritance. The counterpart in American law to this third plank of the Communist Manifesto is the estate tax, often referred to as the death tax. U.S. Congress made their first attempt at a permanent estate tax in 1862, second and successful attempt in 1916 under the Revenue Act of 1916. All right, let's try to speed this up a little. The fourth plank, confiscation of the property of all emigrants with an E and rebels. In the United States, we refer to this as government seizures and tax liens. There is also an executive order 11490, sections 1205 and 2002, which gives private land to the Department of Urban Development. This also includes the imprisonment of terrorists who speak out or write against the government, passed in 1997 in a crime and terrorist-related bill. Or this also includes the IRS confiscation of property without any due process. I guess we could add seizures of property related to the victimless crime of drugs to that as well. Five, the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital, an exclusive monopoly, established by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. All banks, of course, right down to the smallest local banks, are beholden to the Federal Reserve System and are regulated by the FDIC, which also relates back to the first plank as far as ownership and private property is concerned. The sixth plank, centralization of the means of communications and transportation in the hands of the state. Here we move not only beyond the release of the Communist Manifesto book, but also beyond the Russian Revolution and into the 1920s. The Federal Radio Commission, established in 1927. The Federal Communications Commission, established in 1934. The Air Commerce Act in 1926. The Civil Aeronautics Act of 1938. The Federal Aviation Agency, 1958. And later, the Department of Transportation assumed control of all of these smaller agencies in 1966. We have the Federal Highway Act of 1916, where federal funds are made available to states for highway construction with strings attached. And this actually relates to a lot of these federally sponsored DWI programs that offer monetary rewards to local police departments today. The Interstate Highway System of 1944, which was funded in 1956. The Interstate Commerce Commission was given authority by Congress to regulate trucking and carriers and inland waterways. And we see why there are so many people out there on the road driving these trucks who are, at the very least, libertarian-leaning, because of these bureaucracies that they are forced to deal with on a regular basis. The seventh plank, extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state. I'm reading this.
In bringing into cultivation of wastelands and the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan, the Department of Agriculture, established in 1862, the Agriculture Adjustment Act of 1933, part of the New Deal, farmers receive government aid if and only if they relinquish control of farming activities. This also includes other New Deal programs like the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which has this great success called the Hoover Dam, finished in 1936. The eighth plank, equal liability of all to labor. Establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. Now, you could trace this all the way back to the establishment of labor unions, which is like early 1800s, but I really don't think that's fair. There was a national labor union established shortly after the Civil War. The AFL, which we talked about in the first show, was not originally a very radical organization. They didn't have strong anti-capitalist leanings. They were established in the 1880s. But then we have things like the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, which placed railroads under federal regulation. The establishment of the Department of Labor in 1913. Labor management negotiations were sanctioned under the Railway Labor Act of 1926, the Civil Works Administration of 1933, National Labor Relations Act of 1935. This was one of the reasons why we often pin a lot of the cartelization of business on the New Deal and the policies and programs of Franklin Roosevelt, because this is where a lot of industry started to coalesce together and kind of recognize the government and what appeared to be at certain points an alliance between the government and labor. And that is why today we use the word big in front of certain industries, because of the cartelization of those industries in response largely to the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. The stated purpose of that act was to free interstate commerce from disruptive strikes by eliminating the cause of the strike. We also have another New Deal program, the WPA, Works Progress Administration, established in 1935. Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, which mandated things like the 40-hour work week and time and a half for overtime, and the establishment of a minimum wage scale. The Civil Rights Act, which could also be tied to the first plank of the Communist Manifesto, was passed in 1964, and I understand that that is a hard one to argue against, but it is an example of government intrusion into both labor and property. Oh, and add to that, affirmative action. The ninth plank, the combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries, gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of population over the country. Or, in a word, in America, Monsanto. But to speak about this more generally, the takeover of factory farming. Some of this is dealt with in the Planning Reorganization Act of 1949, further zoning laws, and various executive orders establishing agricultural regions of the country. Also involved in this, the Farmers' Home Administration, which has this history of buying up smaller farms and creating these farming conglomerates. Plank 10, free education for all children in public schools, abolition of children's factory labor in its present form, combination of education with industrial production. Well, if you've ever sat in a school, if that deals with the last part, that feeling that you have of simple, mindless tasks over and over again while you're designated to one station until there is some kind of whistle or bell sending you to a new location to repeat basically the same process, a combination of education with industrial production. For the rest of that, we have seen and we have discussed on this show a gradual shift from education as a privately funded enterprise to publicly funded schooling, especially in the northern states, which goes back really as early as the 1820s and the 1830s. Federal money began to fund specialized education in the late 1800s. We have the Smith-Lever Act of 1914 for vocational education, the Smith-Hughes Act of 1917, and the Federal School Lunch Program, 1935, the National School Lunch Act of 1946, National Defense Education Act of 1958, right up to the things that we've been talking about in recent shows, the establishment of the Federal Department of Education and the subsequent attempts, one after the other, to centralize control and influence of schooling
and to take control away from the local level and the parents. Powerful organizations like the NEA attach themselves to these super powerful and centralized bureaucracies to increase their control as well. And plank 10, this is really the linchpin of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto, in my opinion. These 10 planks represent the political embodiment of the ideology of collectivism. And whether it's related to Marx and Engels and Lenin and Stalin or not, the ideology of collectivism offers the ultimate tools of political, economic, and social control. So did all of these things really come to be in America, these 10 planks, or at least parts of them, as a result of some conspiracy that originated in Russia? No. But the conspiracy was real. The widespread embrace of collectivist principles, whether we're talking about the 19-aughts, the 19-teens, the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, that widespread embrace, whether it was a conscious embrace, whether people understood what they were accepting or not, even accepting it reluctantly as part of the herd, that would be the means of delivery. And during this time, these changes, this subversion, this infiltration, was palpable. But unfortunately, from what I can gather anyway, the people didn't have the philosophy. They didn't have an understanding of the concepts. They didn't have the vocabulary. They didn't have the contextual history to recognize and fully understand and explain to themselves and to others what was happening. And this is why the needle on the barometer moved so much. Whether we're talking about race riots and lynchings in the 1920s, right up through contentious gavel-banging hearings and witch hunts in the Senate and the House in the 1950s. It seems, from my research anyway, it seems that almost everybody in American society, from the public to the politicians to the people in the media, could see the shadow of the enemy, but they couldn't see a face. So they imagined what that face was. It was the Russians. It was German spies. It was blacks. It was immigrants. It was the other political party. It was the availability of alcohol. It was unions, etc., etc. And during that time, collectivism took over. The 19-teens on the prior values that it, at the very least people talked about in America were abandoned in favor of this ideology of control, which offers easy answers for lazy minds or unconscious minds, or at the very least to give people the benefit of the doubt, poorly informed minds. The title of this series is How the Truth Became Illegal. And along the way, we've looked at some of the statutes that contributed to this, that made it harder for people to tell the truth or to make truths available for public consumption. Because as a new legal structure was developed, beginning in the 19-teens and continuing right up to today, where the face of the truth teller, the face of the whistleblower, could be superimposed onto the shadow of the enemy. If you want to say that, you're a communist. If you want to say that, you're a terrorist. We know how that goes. But the truth, unfortunately, sadly, was an easy thing to take away. Because most people didn't really seem to care what it was or know how to discover it for themselves. For example, well, I don't know, from the 19-teens right up to the fall of the Berlin Wall, they all agreed that a certain economic and political system was bad and that it needed to be fought at all costs. Well, at the same time, strangely, they accepted almost all of it. I want to close today with a couple of excerpts from a book called None Dare Call It a Conspiracy, written in 1971 by Gary Allen. First, page 32. Most of us believe socialism is what the socialists want us to believe it is. a share the wealth program. That is the theory. But is that how it works? Let us examine not only the socialist countries according to the socialist definition of the word extant in the world today. These are communist countries. The communists themselves refer to these as socialist countries, as in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Here, in the reality of socialism, you have a tiny oligarchical clique at the top, usually numbering no more than 3% of the total population, controlling the total wealth, total production, and the very lives of the other 97%. If one understands that socialism is not a share the wealth program, but is in reality a method to consolidate and control the wealth, then the seeming paradox of super-rich men promoting socialism becomes no paradox at all. Instead, it becomes the logical, even the perfect tool of power-seeking megalomaniacs. Communism, or more accurately, socialism, is not a movement of the downtrodden masses, but of the economic elite. This is reinforced on page 35. If you wanted to control the nation's manufacturing, commerce, finance, transportation, and natural resources, you would only need to control the apex, the power pinnacle, of an all-powerful socialist government. Then you would have a monopoly and could squeeze out all of your competitors. If you wanted a national monopoly, you must control a national socialist government. If you want a worldwide monopoly, you must control a world socialist government. That is what the game is all about. Communism is not a movement of the downtrodden masses, but is a movement created, manipulated, and used by power-seeking billionaires in order to gain control over the world. First, by establishing socialist governments in the various nations, and then consolidating them all through a great merger into an all-powerful world socialist superstate. Guy sounds pretty paranoid, doesn't he? But all the while, there is an infiltration, there is a subversion, there is a takeover. And the conspirators will start providing a new truth, air quotes, that goes far more into specifics than just the generalities of collectivism. Their project began in the late 1800s, and in the next episode, we will, to borrow a popular phrase, name names. Take care.